New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get two snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, back in the home studio again, hopefully got the tech set up correct this time. I seem to be getting better at that. I wanted to do a podcast on US elections, because I hear there's one coming up, and it might be significant. Now, I don't know why, but last time I got the impression that that wasn't quite as peachy clean as it should have been. And I've also got this sneaking suspicion that perhaps the next one might not be as sneaky clean as it should have been. So I thought, who do I know who can set my mind at ease that actually everything is currently well in the US with their election process? And for that, I've got the great Semiagog. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate your good humor in getting this thing arranged, and I'm very happy to be here. Although I have to say, I'm not entirely sure that I'm the best person to set the minds of those in your audience at ease, being somewhat skeptical myself.
Ah, right. Okay. Well, we best get into that. For anyone who's not familiar, where do you put your stuff out, and what kind of stuff do you do?
Well, I'm all over the place, I'd say. You can find my material on YouTube. It's backed up on BitChute. Much of it makes its way over to Odyssey. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Telegram. I am on Gab, though, less often these days. So really, Twitter and YouTube are the main places to find me. The kind of things I do, there's sort of a core of geopolitics, the great game, global strategy, this sort of thing. But I've also got...
Yes.
A number of other interests. There's stuff on esoterica, the overlap between secret services and secret societies. And then there are a number of like one-off streams that happen from time to time. Like I've got one coming up that I'm in the works on planning about Black Sabbath. There's another one I've done about Conan the Barbarian viewed from the right. So there's all kinds of material on the channel. But the core is geopolitics and strategy.
Yeah, I mean, you've got some really good stuff on there. Some of the Ukrainian ones really stood out for me, actually. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff on there, but there's some of the recent Ukrainian ones I found to be fascinating. That's something you've certainly kept on top of. So, thank you very much. That's absolutely excellent. So, look, first question I've got for you is, over here, we are often told by US commentators, every time an election comes up, they say that this is going to be the most important election of our lifetime. Now, I don't think I believed them when it was John McCain versus Obama, because I don't think that it would have made the slightest jot of difference whichever one of them got in. And I didn't believe it when it was Romney versus Obama. But after that, I must say, I started believing it a bit more when it was Hillary versus Trump. So what are the odds that this one will indeed also be the most important election of our lifetime? Is there any truth to that?
Well, yes, insofar as, you know, great affairs of state and great powers, you know, affect all of us. It's certainly an important one for the United States. And, you know, as I've seen many of my friends abroad, you know, I've learned that they all watch events in the United States, knowing that, you know, what's the old expression? Shit flows downhill, you know. You know, people around the world are forced to suffer the consequences in ways that are often more striking and more unpleasant, for example, than even the people in the United States. I mean, the things going on in the Middle East and Ukraine and all kinds of things historically illustrate that. I think it is. It's certainly going to be another turning point. You know, there's this old idea of the fork in the road, you know, the point at which you arrive at this major point of potential divergence. And I think each one of the elections, certainly 2016, 2020, and increasingly so 2024, all fit that pattern.
Okay.
And that's bearing in mind that there's probably considerable truth to this idea of the uniparty. And so I don't want to set that hypothesis aside, but in certain respects, I think everyone in the United States who is sober and views this thing as close to objectively as they can, there are two choices. And those choices, I think in the case of the United States, are probably a bit more stark and different than, for example, what you're dealing with, you know, Labour and the Conservatives and the rest in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, our election has got a bit more interesting lately. I mean, it was going to be swapping out one part of the Uniparty for another part, but it looks like we might actually have the option to destroy one part of the Uniparty here. So our election's got slightly more interesting. I'm pleased to say that. But I mean, looking at yours, I mean, you've got somebody who's on one hand got a proven track record of starting no new wars, going up against somebody who has a proven track record of escalating towards World War III with a nuclear armed superpower. So, I mean, it really does feel to me like that, on top of the fact that if they did cross a Rubicon in 2020, which I'm inclined to believe they did, it's going to be fascinating to see if they are actually willing to cross back across that Rubicon, or whether there is going to be some sort of shenanigans coming as well, which is, you know, exactly why I wanted to talk to you, because I obviously have substantial concerns that democracy could be on the verge of going away.
Yeah, well, there are a number of ways of looking at the whole question of democracy and whether or not the people and their votes really have much to do at all with, you know, great affairs and who comes into office. So leaving that aside, you know, our mutual friend, academic agent, talks at length, and I think convincingly about elite theory, you know, Pareto and Mosca and some of the other people that he's discussed in his recent books. So that's one thing to think about. How much do our votes actually matter? But leaving that question aside, and it's an important one, certainly the process has been undergoing degradation consistently since at least 2016. I remember at the time of the 2016 election, that's when Trump came out with fake news. I began to follow it very, very closely in 2015 because I saw, you know, all Trump supporters are Nazis and Trump, you know, he's calling Mexicans rapists. And I saw the massive sort of hysterical press coverage that we have become accustomed to now at this point. And I want to gesture back to 2016 because we'd seen it before and we're used to that sort of fever pitch around election time and, you know, let's dig up any dirt on anyone we can. But there was something about it that had qualitatively changed as well as, you know, quantitatively, there was an increase in the intensity. And this continued throughout the entire period of Trump's time in office. And I just out of memory, I began to think about the things that happened before, during, and to some extent, some of this extended into the period after Trump's presidency. You had all the Russiagate stuff. You had the mid-year and crossfire hurricane investigations. Christopher Steele, the Steele dossier, the so-called P-tapes, all sorts of odd connections between operatives in the United States, in Britain, other ones further afield, like Joseph Mifsud. And then you have this stuff with George Papadopoulos, Paul Manafort, people going to jail, all sorts of charges being brought. There's Mike Flynn stuff. Then there were remember the Peter Strzok and Lisa Page text messages?
That was Democratic, crazy, yeah.
Democratic emails and Seth Rich somehow, you know, happening to die. And nobody decided to take his watch or wallet. They just shot him in the street.
Yep, mugged for nothing.
Yes, Imran Awan, the Pakistani IT staffer who worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was sending all kinds of money home to Pakistan and was carrying, apparently, this is all, everything I say in this discussion, it's all speculation. I'm no expert on this. I'm not making strong assertions of fact, as we'll see as we look at all of this. Lots of people who do try to speak out or talk about what happened. It seems that we're not limited to being gaslighted. We can also be prosecuted. So, you know, I'd like to be very careful about how I talk about these things, because we're in 2024 and it's only going to get worse. But Imran Awan and the laptop stuff, Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, all the Trump rape and sexual harassment claims, you know, more than a score of women, if I remember correctly, Fang Fang and Eric Swalwell, you know, the Chinese spy, Senator Dianne Feinstein's Chinese driver, the Chinese driver who worked apparently for Chinese intelligence, all the Epstein stuff. So I didn't do that just to sort of, you know, remind everyone. I want to paint a picture of how much corruption, how much there is in the way of allegations, but also how much of this stuff has subsequently been swept under the rug. And so you see this very strong division, which matters when we come to lawfare and how it bears on all of this. We see a very strong trend, like Imran Awan, he pleads guilty to one bank fraud thing and it all gets swept under the rug. Did you ever hear anything about Fang Fang and Swalwell, any charges being brought? Anything with Dianne Feinstein and having a Chinese spy?
Well, I remember the stories, but I don't remember the conclusions. So I don't know what happened.
Often how it worked out. Well, certainly nothing that's the equivalent of the multiple prosecutions that are directed at Trump at present, which is one of the things I want to underscore. So this began, this intense fight began prior to 2016, and it extended past the election. So part of what we've seen is an extension of that hysterical phase straight through without pause, straight through the terms of office, leading, you know, there's some dips and peaks, certainly, but we see a kind of accusatory hysteria in the media, as well as the gaslighting and debunking and fact checking going constantly. So, one of the major things that's happened is that our source of information across the board has been thoroughly vitiated, you know, disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, all these sorts of terms they have for it. So, yeah, we have we've seen such a shift, as well as all the polarization, that, you know, when you ask this fundamental question, to come back to it, you know, is democracy under threat, in a sense, you know, that we could be, you know, waving bye-bye to it. Yes. And I think we've already gotten there. And what I've been attempting to say here, I'm sorry, in my long-winded way, is that after a fashion, we're in a state of warfare that we are not accustomed to thinking about. We generally think of warfare as this thing that happens in a war. There's a state of war. There's a declaration of war. And then the war's ended when there's peace. You know, you might have a conflict, but that's a conflict. There's a conflict zone. You know, soldiers will be sent there. Rules of engagement will apply. And we have distinct domains of civil and martial life, which is why, you know, when there's a big problem, we have martial law. But the thing is that so many states of emergency have been imposed in the United States, certainly. I imagine it's similar in Britain, that we're operating now under overlapping states of exception that extend government power that never end. And they're answers to crises in the same way that the declaration of martial law would be. And so when you combine the fact that it's an ongoing crisis, that it seems to be a kind of war, a low intensity war, staffers getting shot in the street, Antifa being mobilized to attack Trump supporters as they come out of rallies, lawfare, what gets called anarcho-tyranny, you know, a judiciary that in many respects is wanting. You know, when you think about all of these things at once, I think it's important to understand that we're in a continuous state of a kind of low-level war that impinges on all our lives. So think about this against the background of democracy. How can you have a democracy? How can you have an election in a state of war?
Well, I mean, I like the analogy to it being a state of war, because, I mean, after all, what is the purpose of a war. The purpose of a war is to get to the other side, controlling more power, resources, land, people, access to taxable resources, access to resources. So if the stakes are the same as a war, well, why wouldn't you treat it as seriously as a war? Because that is exactly what it has become. So why would you not be prepared to do the same exceptional things that you might be prepared to do in a war if the end product is exactly the same? I mean, it seems to me like an apt analogy. One thing I think that would be helpful is just to take a few moments to set out what your process actually is, because I know it's a lot more complicated than ours here. To give a very quick overview of how the UK election system works is, first of all, the candidates are decided by the parties. They used to be decided by the local associations, but that's really functionally no longer the case. It is the parties just select a person and put them in. And then on election day, you turn up at the polling station, you show an ID. You go in, you get given a piece of paper and a pencil. You go into a booth, you mark a cross on a ballot. You can take a biro, a permanent marker if you want, put it on the ballot. You drop that in a box, and that box has got a seal on it that is only broken after those boxes are, at the end of the day, collected up, taken to a central location. And it's normally a big hall, and I've done a number of these myself. You get a big hall like a sports centre. And you'll have a big row of tables around the outside, big table in the middle. The boxes are brought to the middle. The seal is broken in front of representatives from each party. The papers are dumped out. They're then distributed to the outer tables where, again, representatives from each party can stand there, literally just right over the top of it, looking down as they start to sort these votes, count them, bundle them up into piles of 1,000. And then they, once they're in a pile, they go back to the centre table and you can see the vote progress by the night. And normally by about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, it's very obvious to everybody exactly where you stand, who's winning. And if it's close, I think within 5% or maybe a bit tighter than that, you can ask for a recount. But the whole process is entirely transparent. It's quite hard to rig a process like that. And so I generally have faith in the UK election process. The only examples that we've had of that going awry is when there's been heavy use of mail-in ballots, which never used to be a thing until the last election, but generally they're not used that heavily here. People do make the effort to go out on the day, so it's quite a simple process, and it's quite difficult to rig it in any particular overt way. But your process appears to be, I mean, a complete mirror. I mean, every part of what I've just described seems to function differently from the primary elections, which obviously get rigged in many cases, if not all cases. I'm thinking of Ron Paul. The first candidate I ever really was rooting for was Ron Paul, and clearly the process was rigged against him. If you're on the left, you might say Bernie Sanders. But then on election day, I've just got no idea how it works. You seem to have these voting machines, and God knows what's going on there. Why you can't just vote in a ballot box? I don't quite understand. So perhaps you could give us just a couple of minutes on what your actual system is.
Well, one of the great problems with that is the degree of decentralization that's involved.
Okay.
So even in federal elections, and there are going to be exceptions to this, there are details with which I'm unfamiliar, so bear that in mind. But in terms of the general picture, federal election, like when you, for the upcoming 2024 election, for, you know, when I voted in 2016 and 2020, presidential election, you're also going to have members of Congress, mm-hmm. candidates for Congress on the ballot, these sorts of things, and they'll throw in other things sometimes, referenda and things related to municipalities and the rest, depending on, you know, what kind of ballot it is or where it's happening. It's highly decentralized. So here's something that I pulled up the other day, and it's just, this is from the United States Election Assistance Commission. Now I'm not entirely sure that this is a government. Oh yeah, it is. It's a government email. So basically they say, who is in charge of elections in my state? The answer here is each state has a chief election official who has an oversight or advisory role over state or federal elections. Like, for example, that could be a secretary of state. However, elections are usually administered at the county level. So not only do you have all 50 different states, but you've got the counties where the elections take place. They say, though, in some states, cities or townships run elections. No two states administer elections in the same way, and there can be variations within a single state. Elections can be run by a single individual or department, a board or commission of elections, or a combination of two or more entities. Election administration in America is highly decentralized. There are more than 10,000 election jurisdictions in the United States. The size of the jurisdictions varies, you know, a few hundred in some places. Others have as many as 5 million people. And so when you think about this, there are enormous differences. So there's some sort of basic background things that you can conceive of. If you're a soldier fighting abroad or stationed abroad, I should say, then you can fill out an absentee ballot. Likewise for some sort of, you know, embassy employee living and working abroad, that kind of thing. So these absentee ballots come in. Then there are the people who go to choose to vote on the day. There are mail-in ballots. And now there's a kind of mail-in ballot harvesting that in many states is permitted, which is where you just go collect big bundles of ballots from people and on their behalf. You know, a lot of that happens with care homes that house the elderly, retirement homes, these sorts of places. Oddly enough, those are places that were sort of locked off, permitting all sorts of, you know, intermediaries to operate in the 2020 election as a result of the medical condition that shall not be named.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.